All right, Anders, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
It's been a while since we've chatted.
Yes, it has.
I think we talked last time about Async when you guys first released the initial CTP. Mm-hmm. And now you've done a refresh, and we've done a lot of stuff on Channel 9 about that. But I wanted to get a sense from you. Looks like you guys knocked Async out of the park. I mean, it looks like the way you initially implemented it was right. You haven't made any major changes.
Right. Well, I mean, we've made some minor changes to the code gen pattern based on feedback from our first CTP, and now we have the second CTP out. I believe, it's just out. I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I think one of the good things about that is it now supports the phone, which is a super environment to use these async extensions in.
Yeah.
No, you're right. We have not made any major changes. I mean, it was all based on task of T that was in .NET Framework 4.0. Mm. And we've stuck with that, and I think that's going to serve us well. We've optimized as much as we can, for common patterns. And so I think it's, I mean, it's, you know, it's continuation passing style language support is really, in a sense, what it boils down to. Mm. And that's the kind of programming that has always been a little wonky, because you have this inversion of control that happens in your code, and like constructs that are very common, like for loops or whatever, almost become almost impossible to write or look very strange, And we've sort of demystified a lot of that and just made your code look like normal code. And to me, that was the high order bit always, was I don't want us to solve the async problem by teaching you a whole new way of programming, because there's no leverage in that. We want to leverage what you know. You already know how to write loops and conditions and functions and whatever, and let's just stick with that. Mm-hmm. And then let's have the compiler do the heavy lifting of turning it into continuation passing style, which is what it does, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that has worked out very well. So I'm happy about that.
Great. Yeah, I mean, the feedback that I see is people love the simplicity.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while for it to gain adoption, just like Link took a while and like all other things. But it is very useful. And I mean, the little apps I've written with it are just, I mean, it's just wonderful. But it takes a little while to get it, just like these other things. But mm-hmm. but I think it'll serve us well over time. Yeah.
Cool. So I asked the Niners to ask you questions, mm-hmm. And sort of doing this in a kind of old school sort of way. Since we're talking about async, one of the questions that comes up from a Niner exoteric, mm-hmm. Is a technical guy, and he has several questions here, and I'm going to look at the ones specifically for async, so we just talk about that. In some sense, he asks, when is async not appropriate to use?
Yeah. I think there are certain high-frequency scenarios that are probably not appropriate. So async, to me, in a sense, the mental model I use to evaluate whether something should be written as async functions versus synchronous is, think of it as message passing. Would it be, I mean, not that it works that way, but think of compare the overhead of it to writing something with message passing style. Right? Like, would it be too expensive for me to make every function call here by passing a message to some service and getting a result back? Mm. And for certain coarse-grained operations, that would be totally fine. But if you're down there in a loop doing a million iterations over something, you don't want to be passing messages around, to do that. So it's kind of true, too, for async. You don't want to do a million asynchronous calls in a tight piece of logic, because you're going to drown in the overhead of doing it. Because for every invocation of an async method, there's a task object allocated, plus there's further state allocated on the heap. Because in a sense, what the compiler does, the rewrite of an asynchronous method, is it takes what used to be a stack frame and it makes it a heap object, just like an iterator would. And so there's allocations occurring there. And once you get down into really high-frequency scenarios, that overhead starts to show up, and you're just going to stress the GC. And so what you gain, supposedly, in responsiveness by being async, well, you suck that up by consuming memory and stressing the GC thread. And so use it for relatively coarse-grained work. That's what it's intended for.
Excellent.
Yeah.
He also asks, this is an interesting question. I don't think he can necessarily answer this, but you might be able to. How long before the async T virus is permeated through all of .NET? He's meaning, how long until the BCL starts using it to deal with asynchronous stuff?
Right. So we're planning to. So it's not really the async virus, or if you will, if anything, it's sort of the task of T virus, but it's not a virus really, right?
Sure,
but it's a pattern.
Not. Yes.
It's a pattern. And how long will it take for that pattern to permeate?
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll get a long ways in, even in the initial release, or so even in the next coming release of the framework, we're planning to have task of T versions of all of the, or most of the asynchronous library methods that are present today. And then going forward, we will unify on task of T as being the paradigm that we use for asynchrony, where previously we had like the APM, you know, the async programming model with begin async, end async, yada yada, or we had the event-based async model that web client uses, and both have pros and cons, but none of them are easy.
Yeah.
And task of T is nice in that we can unify a bunch of different kinds of asynchrony, you know, computational asynchrony through threads or I/O asynchrony, you know, network-based asynchrony, can all be represented using task of T, and then when you pepper on top of that the language extensions that we're doing for asynchronous methods, you get a much, much nicer programming experience. And I think we'll get a long way, even in the first release of this. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Let's see here. So RHM is the niner, asks, in F-sharp, async is implemented in terms of a more general language facility that is also used to implement the F-sharp equivalent of iterators.
Right.
Mads and Anders have both spoken about how C-sharp async is similar to C-sharp iterators implementation, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
He asks, can you ask Anders? I am. Anders, did you consider implementing a more general language facility to use to implement async in terms of?
Yeah. I think I understand the gist of the languages. Is like, could there be some mechanism that allows you to write code, or methods, if you will, such that you can orchestrate the execution of that code yourself? That I think, in a sense, you know, iterators, you're writing code, but they look just like methods, but the execution is orchestrated differently. It's driven by an enumerator, right? In async, it's driven by continuation passing and task completion. And yet, there are a lot of similarities with how we lift variables, local variables, into heap allocated objects, such that we can extend the lifetime of the stack frame, if you will, the one that isn't there, actually. But you know, once you have two things that sort of look and smell alike, well, is there a class of thing there? I think that's what the question is. Is there some sort of thing that we could introduce that would encompass both and all sorts of other like abstractions?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question. It's something that we pondered. And we could sort of speculate. The problem is I'm not sure that we know of enough other good uses, and there's always a cost to introducing an abstraction. You know, whenever you have an abstraction of something, then you have to map that abstraction onto whatever particular domain, and there's always cost associated with that mapping. So if we had some thing like expression trees or whatever, or statement trees that could represent the code that was in this method, and then we can map it onto iterators, or we can map it onto async methods by dynamically generating the code, for example, right, at runtime. That's one possibility, but there's a lot of cost associated with that, right? So you take a runtime hit, and you take a metadata hit, and at the end of the day, what you buy in terms of convenience may be too expensive, you know, for what you're trying to do. So it's a bit of a balancing act, you know.
Sure.
And I like the fact that at least in the compiler we can reuse a lot of the instrumentation and a lot of the algorithms that we have in place, you know, both for iterators and async. But we're not yet at a point where there's a general purpose abstraction that I feel like we all see and would go, yeah, we should add that. So mm-hmm. so, but it's something to ponder.
Yeah. Excellent. And he actually continued on with about, you know, compiler as a service. Mm-hmm. Could perform these transformations.
Yes, so it could. The compiler does perform these transformations, and I guess there's a question there of could a third party do that once we ship all this compiler as a service stuff that we keep talking about.
Which we'll talk about a little bit.
Yeah, sure, sure. Could a third party then go add their own language extensions this way? And the answer to that would be no. Because the compiler as a service is about representing existing programs and giving you an object model on that and allowing you to do a bunch of interesting things with that. But it's not about having some sort of third-party plug-in model for language extensions. And honestly, I don't know that you could really devise one. I've often been asked this, and I've often thought about it, and then I just use as a mental exercise, well, could we have done link that way? Could we have done iterators? Could we have, and it turns out you look at how it just gets into every little corner of the compiler, and it's really, really hard to wall that off in an extension mechanism.
Sure.
And then version that extension mechanism going forward, such that when we ship new versions of the language with things that we've done in it, all these third-party add-ins to the language would automatically... I don't know that anyone knows how to do that, so we're not doing it.
Okay. Let's see. Let's ask some other ones. Felix9, who's asked several questions on this thread.
Thanks, mm-hmm.
Felix. One of the appreciated practices of .NET language design team is that they always have the tooling needs in mind. Optimize the language for things like IntelliSense and refactoring, etc. But Touch Studio guys have discovered that the Touch UI or NUI has unique tooling needs. Any thought on that front? So the Touch Studio is essentially an app that the Rise team has made, or Wolfram Schulte's group, which is basically writing code on your phone.
Yeah. I think I saw a demo of it.
Which and it's actually quite interesting,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generating some interest, I mean, to write code on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he's asking what you think about that.
Well, I'm just going to dream here, but I'm not sure how much programming we'll be doing on our phones. I'm not sure that particular form factor is super conducive to a good programming experience, but I do think touch will, over time, become more and more prevalent in our desktop experience, if you will, or a tablet experience, right? I mean, once we get bigger tablets with more fully functional,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would fully imagine that, you know, exploring code or whether it be a touch or you know, jumping around in a program or you know, using touch gestures to do a bunch of stuff that you do today, or whole new things like zooming into, I don't know, depictions of programs and whatever. Yeah, I mean,
interesting.
Yeah, but I can't say that it's something that I do day to day today.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Adam Spate, 2008, asked, will VB.NET and C# ever have the ability to discriminate methods with the same input type signature but different return types? It seems strange to me that you currently cannot do this, as the required return, where stated, is known before the method is selected.
Yeah. I saw that question online and the examples that accompanied it, and it looked to me like he was proposing using the you know, you have two functions with the same name taking the same parameters, mm-hmm. one returning an int, one returning a string, and the fact that when you call one, you're assigning the result to an int, and when you call the other, you're assigning it to a string, that would do the overload resolution, the fact that you are assigning it to something where you're saying what return type you want. Mm-hmm. And it's true that you could probably make that work, but that's not all that character. That's really a very, very small subset of how you call functions. What about if you're calling a function in an expression, you know, or in a context where you don't know what it's going to be necessarily assigned to? I mean, we have an axiom in the language that every expression has a type. And it drives fundamentally how overload resolution works and some of the type inference that's in the language. And you start messing with that where the inference comes in the other direction. And a bunch of things shake loose that you wouldn't want to have shake loose. So I'm not sure that it... I mean, it could be fitted into a language that was designed with a different axiom for how these mechanisms work. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we're pretty set in the way we're doing it currently.
Right on. So Steve Richter wants to know what you think about dependency properties in WPF. I don't know how much you know about
that. I do know about them, yeah.
So he says, I find them confusing and difficult to use.
Yeah. I find them confusing at times too, but then again I can sympathize with the issue that it's the notion that a container of objects, say, well, a container of controls, say a layout container that contains some controls, wants to superimpose properties onto the controls that are in it that control how they get laid out, right? So in a sense, the container is wanting to define properties on whatever gets dropped into it, right? But you want extensibility, you want to be able to dream up new kinds of containers that get dreamt up after the things that are going into the containers
sure.
have been created, right? So you can't just say that, well, I guess we could add these properties to all of the things that could possibly go into the containers, but now you create this dependency between the two that you don't really want to have. Dependency properties, which should really be non-dependency or independency properties, because their purpose is to break the dependency between container and containee, so to speak, and allowing the container to impose properties on the containee. Mm. I'm not sure I know of a better way of doing it. It has to be a different thing. It's hard for us to... I mean, we looked at trying to formalize it in the language, and part of the work we did with extension properties, which never... made it into the language. Mm. One of the key intended customers was WPF. But then it turned out that after we had done the whole design and sat down with them and we tried to reconcile it with their dependency properties, it turns out that you couldn't actually do it that way because it would introduce ambiguities. Because they have many, for example, many things want to... add dependency properties with the same name, say text, you know, like this kind of container wants to introduce text of that kind, and now you can't tell which dependency property called text you were dealing with, and so you have to have the container name in the picture as well. It got messy. It got to the point where we sort of realized that, hey, these guys who were our intended to be our primary customer couldn't actually use the feature, and there were other issues with the extension properties, which is why we never ended up doing that.
Interesting.
So much as I think they can be confusing, there's a reason for them being the way they are.
Sure.
Yeah.
So speaking of properties, and this is, you know, related, Mike BCML. Has the C# language team, so let's just say has Anders, ever considered, or would you consider, adding a way to use custom logic with automatically implemented properties? Mm-hmm. And he's provided an example.
Yeah.
Let's see. I often find myself creating private fields that I don't particularly care about.
Right.
And just so I can implement a lock in a property or add some other code.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that?
Well, it keeps coming up. I mean, I hear it over and over. I want auto-implemented properties, but I want them done this way, but I want them done that way, and I want them done the other way. So there's clearly a class of problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've established that, and but it's also in the realm of problems where you want to have users be able to specify the pattern in some way, and then have the compiler pick up on that. And so it's kind of in the metaprogramming realm. Mm-hmm. Of problems, and it's certainly something that we're hoping that the compiler as a service work that we've been doing, you know, specifically one of the things that we want to target with that is metaprogramming, and I use this particular problem sort of as my litmus test for, you know, whether we are on the right track. So I'm hoping we can solve this problem. I'm not going to say when, mm-hmm. but I'm acutely aware of there being a problem there because people keep asking. And I have felt it too, right? I mean, it's
sure.
you know, in the work we did with Link to SQL, for example, it's like, dang, you know, all of these properties all have to follow the same pattern. Why can't I just say what the pattern is and then, you know, you go expand it for me or do whatever needs to be done, right? So
cool.
Yeah.
And so that falls nicely into, I like the way these questions are related. It's nice to see this. But KTR asks, this is related to compiler as a service you just mm-hmm. mentioned. With the future edition of compiler as a service, are there any plans for possible support for metaprogramming? You mentioned mm-hmm. metaprogramming. Mm-hmm. Like yes. possible IDE support for templating in a way that is integrated into the C# language itself?
It's possible. I wouldn't necessarily say templating. I'm hoping we can find something that's a little. I would hesitate to introduce a templating language, you know, and make yet another meta language that's different from the target language. Ideally, the meta language and the target language would be the same, meaning that you would use C# to write the templates, so to speak. Or the code generators, if you will, or whatever you want to call them, right? The things that generate the code. I think that's one of the very powerful things about languages like Ruby or Python or the dynamic programming languages is that they have this eval capability, which is sort of a little bit like the metaprogram I'm talking about. But the beauty of it is that template programming language and the target language are the same, right? So once you know one, you know the other. So it's a very small leap to make into metaprogramming, where C++, you look at a templating language, it's completely different. It's actually a Turing-complete programming language, as far as I've been able to establish. Yet it has very little to do with C++ itself, right? It's a different art form, template programming. And a lot of C++ programmers don't necessarily understand how to write templates. Mm. And I'd like for the two to be the same.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So since we're on this compiler as a service thing, Felix9 asks, so far what we've heard about Roslyn, which is the code name for that, for mm-hmm. everyone to know out there, mm-hmm. Is all about the benefits for other MS groups or the tool vendors, and most realistic examples are all about code highlighters or refactors. Mm-hmm. But how could Roslyn serve us coders directly? So from the developer experience, any thoughts? This question is about broad vision, not blah blah blah. So he's asking, so compiler as a service, what does that mean for your everyday developer using C#?
Well, I think. First of all, I think there's going to be some really nice direct benefits, like an interactive prompt, which everybody is going to want. And once you have one, you're never going to want to give it up again. It's like IntelliSense, you know. It's just going to be one of those that you can't live without.
Okay.
And Roslyn is a deep enabler for us to build that, and to build sort of a more script-like feel. I want C# to feel, in many ways, just like a dynamic programming language, like a completely dynamic programming experience, but with typing. and it's totally possible, and it's going to be great. I'm quite excited about that. And that's you know, sort of very directly something that I think everyone can relate to. There are some more indirect things that, we're going to get out of it, like metaprogramming that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. But I also think, you know, by us enabling maybe just a few people to write better refactorings, code generators, code analysis and insight tools, we're indirectly benefiting a lot of people, right? I mean, right now, the infrastructure that you have to put in place in order to write something that can do refactoring really amounts to a full compiler. And it sometimes amounts to more than a full compiler because you've got to do additional things like intelligent rewrites of the code and whatever. And very few people are capable of doing that or have the time and money to invest into it. And so there's sort of a poverty of potential things, you know, or a poverty of things getting done because it's too expensive to do them, right?
Okay.
But by making it a lot cheaper and a lower barrier to entry, we're hoping to set off not everybody, but a larger number of people on getting these things written. Mm. And that will benefit everybody in a more indirect fashion. But I do feel pretty confident that we're going to get some good outcomes out of that as well.
Cool. So one of the questions I have would be, is compiler as a service, how far does it go? So in other words, could I say, I want to use Roslyn to, instead of this output, I want this output.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to give me that level of control? And then I sort of, or would I just write my own compiler and not use the compiler?
No. It'll enable you to orchestrate execution of code, first of all. So you can say, here's a snippet of source code,
mm-hmm.
and here's the sort of surrounding environment, the things that are in scope, so to speak, right, and the things that this piece of code can see mm-hmm. and operate on. And now please compile this snippet of code and run it right now, or give me a delegate that I can call to run the code, or give me an expression tree that I can analyze and further transform into SQL or what have you or something, right? So,
nice.
Yeah, a bunch of these services will be right there.
Cool.
Yeah, we're locking down API designs and stuff. Yeah, so
that's great. Mm-hmm. So you know, which is a good question. I mean, how's that going? How's the
project? Oh, it's going good.
You guys on track?
Oh yeah.
Right
I'd
on.
Say so.
Felix again. He asked so many questions. I feel sort of responsibility to.
You're the virtual Felix.
These.
Yeah.
So as a former Delphi coder. Felix wonders how many concepts you put into Delphi's VCL framework and Object Pascal language. How many concepts put into Delphi's VCL Object Pascal language moved into C# and the CLR? And how they improved or changed during this? So he says, I know Delphi has mentioned pointers, which is similar to single cast delegates. It's way better than function pointers in C++, but C#'s multicast delegates are even better. So it's just kind of a random techie question.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think programming languages, it's like any new programming language is 10% new and 90% state-of-the-art, you know, picking the best of what else has been done in the industry. I mean, it's a little more than 10% new, but it's a fairly slow moving art form, and you know, when you design a programming language, there's just a bunch of stuff that every language has to have, right? I think some of the things that got pioneered in Delphi, although they undoubtedly existed in other languages before Delphi, but at least were front and center there, was like stuff like properties and events, giving first class treatment to those, and that certainly was carried over into C#, and I think has served as well, you know, and now it's pretty much standard fare in in every programming language, and it certainly wasn't back then. And you know, well, so the notion of having sort of an object-oriented UI framework that you can inherit from, but that also has a visual designer associated with. I mean, there were a bunch of similarities there between that and Windows Forms and WPF, but you know.
Sure. Right on. So let's move on. I want to try to get as many as I can. I know we've got some time. So Boss talks about, in one of your talks, probably PDC-10, you talked about a lot of ceremony. What he's asking is, during that talk, you also kind of demonstrated your sort of distaste for optional parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's saying, what Boss is saying, essentially, is that with optional parameters, you can actually decrease the ceremony and make things, you know, smaller.
More succinct. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What do you think about? His question is, why are you so not into optional parameters?
Well, hey, we did them. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, so I felt, you know, and in retrospect, maybe I was being a little naive that you know, but I felt that overloading was a perfectly acceptable alternate mechanism for getting the effects of optional parameters. And in some ways I thought that I still feel actually that overload resolution version's a little better because the defaults don't get hardwired in the call sites. They're up to the implementation, and so you can at least in theory change what the defaults are and not have a version break, you know. That said, you know, there's a whole bunch of COM code out there that already uses default parameters. VB has default parameters. We kept getting asked, and so we ended up doing them in C# 4.0. And I'm happy we did, and I think they are useful, and we're actually making use of them now in the Roslyn API. So they're probably not as bad as I had originally thought.
Yeah.
And they can decrease the ceremony in some cases. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So Richard Hine asks, are there any thoughts with C# supporting higher kinds?
Yeah, higher kind of types.
Yeah. I'm assuming that's what he means.
Probably. Yeah, it's not something we're looking at.
And let me
actively
ask you, what for people out there, like, what benefit would it give you? I mean, what?
Well, it's there are certain kinds of generic patterns that get you into the business of having higher kinded or higher order types, but it's I won't even attempt to explain it here. It sort of gets you, like monads are one example of a higher ordered kind of type that if you could abstract over any kind of monad, you know, but whether that's particularly useful, I mean, yes, there are cases where it's useful, but I also think that it's just the fact that you have to do so much explaining before anyone really gets what it is you're trying to do is perhaps an indicator that it's not ready for prime time. Scala has higher kind of types. I'm not sure to what extent they support them, but I believe they're in there. But I'm not seeing a lot of demand. Let's just put it that way.
Well, Richard is one of the Niners that spends a lot of time watching. You know, sort of the Eric Meyer lecture
and stuff that we've
pimped a lot of monadic stuff on CNET, which is good. Is expanding.
Right.
So it's good to ask.
Right, and who knows? You know, I mean, it's. But I'm not sure that I see given what it would cost to implement that, you know, in the framework and in two languages and at least, you know, I'm not sure the payoff's there.
Ian 2 asks, can you conceive of a time where you don't have to write code, and that in some sense you can develop full-featured applications? You know, we had talked earlier about maybe touch, and I mean, that's just kind of. I mean, it seems like the keyboard writing characters is always going to be necessary. But what do you think about that? You see a world where...
Well, you know, there was a time where, in fact, I devoted a year and a half of my life before coming to Microsoft on exploring different ways of programming. Back when I was in Portland, we had this project called Monet that was all about visual programming. Back when one of the industry buzzwords was software ICs that you could just wire together, you know, and they just had inputs and outputs, and, you know, you wouldn't even be writing lines of code anymore. You'd just be doing diagrams, and you'll be pictorially writing your programs, and it was, you know, it demoed fantastically well. It was made for some awesome demos of centigrade to Fahrenheit converters, and we had the market corner on that. But, you know, you try to write any kind of real app, though, and, oh, my God, you died sort of a slow death in wires going from everywhere to everywhere. And we kind of see that, too, in some of these big abstract views of big, complicated systems, you know, that just get murderously expensive or complicated to look at, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're trying to sort of show all the dependencies at once, which you just can't do. I don't know. I'm sort of at peace with using with using text and programming languages for expressing ourselves. It's the best we have. I don't see anything radically different coming out of there. I think in certain domains we'll always have like things that feel like you're programming or automating tasks, you know, just by showing what you want done, and then the system goes and does it for you on a bunch of things, for example. But real apps are about integrating systems that weren't written the right way, or, you know, or were used a different paradigm, or you know, cracking this XML document, or. Sure. I mean, it's dirty business, you know, and you need powerful tools to do it. And in spite of the fact that we present simpler user experiences every day, the stuff that goes behind isn't getting any simpler. You know, it's in many ways getting more complicated, right? And so I'm afraid programming is here to stay, you know, as far as I can tell.
Right on. Yeah. Josh Ross. Ross, sorry, Josh. Josh Ross.
Say that 10 times.
Yeah, exactly. Are there things that C# programmers are writing today that behave one way in x86, but have different performance characteristics when run on a processor like ARM? I would imagine that having similar caches and no branch prediction hardware would have some design impact somewhere. So are there things to consider when you're targeting ARM versus... 86.
Well, I think the biggest thing right now is the fact that some of the ARM chassis that are out there in phones are single processor, and that means, for example, you can't run your GC on a background thread, and without getting stuttery UI, and so that's one thing that definitely impacts. You know, once we get multi-core ARMs, you know, widely available. That stumbling block will go away, if you will. I think the ARM has a simpler memory model and simpler, you know, architecture. But you know, x86 architectures used to be simpler, and then it's not like, you know, we've dramatically changed the way we program them over the last 10 years whilst they've gotten all these predictive caches and whatever. I think it's not going to affect so much you or I. It's going to affect whoever writes the JIT compiler or the back end for that particular system, you know. That's really sort of the level to which that particular concern rises.
Absolutely. And so for like Windows Phone, which runs on ARM, there's a JIT in there. And
there is. Yeah.
So let's see. Let's go down to... Richard Hine asks, what language features of any languages that you know about or think about do you feel a bit jealous of at this time and would like to see make into C#? So, like, what inspires you? What kind of...
Yeah. Well, we talked about some of it earlier with the metaprogramming capabilities of the dynamic programming languages.
Yep.
That they definitely can make me envious at times.
Sure.
I have... over the last several years, been very inspired by a lot of the stuff that's happening in functional programming languages and continue to be inspired by that.
Cool.
Yeah, and it's fun to see some of the I mean, I've been looking at JavaScript, you know, recently, and then some of the stuff that goes on there, you know, and then some of the things you can do with JavaScript's functional features are interesting with closures. I mean, not that we don't have them in C Sharp, but the way they get used to provide privacy, and which actually they end up being the only mechanism in JavaScript that guarantees privacy, which is a little bit mind-blowing, you know, but from coming from, you know, the side of other programming languages, but that's just sort of interesting to ponder, you know.
So, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, speaking of which, I mean, this is going to be a question from Charles and me. At Mix 11, we did a JavaScript panel, and as everybody knows, you know, we're, you know, HTML5, we're pounding it out there, and, you know, JavaScript is being used by so many developers, and it's such an interesting language because it's functional, imperative, object-oriented with prototypes. It's dynamic. It's just, I wanted to get your opinion. How much time you've been studying it, but I mean, you know about the language.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of JavaScript from a language designer's perspective, and are you surprised that it's being used in so many different ways?
No, I am not surprised, because I think the reason that it's being used in so many different ways is that we are moving towards a more heterogeneous world of clients, if you will, with all the devices that we lug around, phones, tablets, PCs, you know, and that run different operating systems and then different stacks of software on them, you know, it's that there's, if you want to be able to broadly target that whole class, you know, you, about the only game in town right now is JavaScript, right? And so there's sort of like a necessity that underlies, you know, this drive towards JavaScript that a lot of programmers are on. Luckily, JavaScript is a nice programming language. It's nice with a couple of really bad things in it, like global variables that you accidentally end up creating, you know, with no errors being reported, or anything. Like, there's some, I think, mistakes around, you know, how this parameter works in the language and whatever. And I think these mistakes are recognized by the ECMAScript committee and by the community, and people do a lot of work to work around them. JavaScript is a completely dynamic language, which has pros and cons. There are a bunch of interesting things you can do with it, and I think there's a bunch of interesting libraries being built that use these capabilities. But I also kind of look at it and I go, wow, that's an amazingly unsafe programming environment, right? I mean, where you do just the wrong thing here, and nothing tells you you did the wrong thing, and poof. And things blow up, and then they blow up maybe in ways that you could not possibly predict, right? Because there is no type checking at all. There are no types in the language. But even without types, like I said, there are also these pitfalls that can be dangerous. And so I think it's a rich environment. It's a target-rich environment for improvement. Now we'll see how that improvement comes about. You know, as it matures.
Sure.
It is interesting that the language has sort of sat out there for 10 years, you know, in a sense, and all of a sudden now there's this big interest. And I think that's driven by the increasing heterogeneity of the client computing environment. You know,
sure.
Reach is king. And so, in a sense, it's the triumph of good enough, you know, over perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say, you know, for a 2 or 3 week effort of Brendan Eich, you know, he did pretty well for 2 or 3 weeks, you know.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it's not bad at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think they're thinking about working on are adding modules, which would be useful.
Oh, I think modules, prototypes, you know, some form of abstraction, you know, be it classes or, I mean, you know, yes, you can do prototypes-based programming in JavaScript, but boy, it's like, it's not for the faint of heart. And so practically every JavaScript library out there comes with its own form of of abstraction, you know, like for making classes or whatever. And unfortunately, they're all different, you know, and so there's a lot of churn right now, but there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Yeah, but I'm definitely keeping my eyes open.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So Anders is keeping his eyes on JavaScript. That's awesome. This is from Dr. Herbie.
Mm-hmm.
As each release adds new keywords and concepts, do you miss the simplicity of the first version of C#? And then the second question is, I'm going to let you answer the first question first.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all pine for simpler days or you know, but it's the price of being an adopted platform, right? I mean, you can't stand still either.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that there is any way of, the only way that we could possibly make C# simpler is by breaking everybody's code. And that is just not acceptable when you have an established user base. It's perfectly acceptable in languages that have no adoption, but they're also kind of pointless. I mean, other than as research vehicles, or you know, that I'm not gonna say that's pointless, right? But but it's simply, like I said, the price of having a user community, and we care a lot about our users, and we are not gonna go break their code, and that means we're gonna have to take the backwards compatibility tax, and that tax gets increasingly higher, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's a way out of that. We just got to keep the language vibrant and young, and then sort of hopefully we can, as we introduce new features, we can sort of make it pretty clear what are the ones that you shouldn't use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if generics had been there in version 1.0, we wouldn't have had array list or you know, other certain classes in the framework, because we would have only had the generic list of T and dictionary, you know, but there it is, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. So it leads into a second question, which is, I mean, when you think about C#,
mm-hmm.
do you see it as a complete language, or do you spend your time sort of looking at it and thinking about what's missing? And that's what Dr. Herbie is asking. You yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always a list of things that I feel are missing, but often then when you try to add the missing things, they create more friction than you know, or more, I don't know. It's like Matt's likes to say that, you know, I wouldn't want anyone to program in my favorite language that has all of the features that I would want in I'm not sure exactly how he says it, but you know, his point is, if you were to go add all of your favorite features to your language, it would be such a cacophony of stuff that doesn't play nice together, right? Mm. Because language design is not just about features, it's about the interaction of features.
Mm.
You know, how do features, do they all, do all of the parts come together and form a greater whole, right?
Mm.
Or do they just form a big, noisy piece of thing that has, like, that has sharp edges everywhere, right? And so we definitely think of the language as a whole language. We always think of the language as a whole language, but we think a lot about, you know, about, are we better off leaving this out?
Sure.
Than putting it in, right?
Yeah.
And that you can only evaluate by thinking about all of the other aspects that it might affect, you know, as opposed to the sort of blinders on, wouldn't this be nice for this particular little problem, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, I mean, in terms of big languages with lots of capabilities, you know, I asked what you thought about JavaScript. What do you think about C++? Like, do you spend any time thinking about, you know, that language, which guys on this floor that are...
What do you think? C++ was one of the original sort of inspirations for C sharp, you know, Java was another, and then of course, you know, Pascal and Delphi and that lineage, you know, that sure. I came from myself. And you know, C++ is one of those languages that has really driven the industry forward and has probably had more impact than I'm hard pressed to think of other languages, but COBOL, Fortran, it's in that very exclusive class of of languages that have moved the industry. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's going to continue to, I think, and it you know it's still it's strong out there, and they have, you know, C++ has a larger probably base of coders than pretty much anything, I would imagine, you know, so
yeah,
it's not going anywhere.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I asked just because it's like the curly brace kind of reality seems to be, even in JavaScript, right? People are using curly braces, and they have semicolon insertion that the compiler does for you, which is really kind of lame, but interesting. It seems like the C syntax has won. Now, not that people aren't using VB.NET, so don't get me wrong, and there's people
it's more, but I think there is a style of well, I wouldn't say it's won necessarily. I mean, you look at, like, I mean, what's in vogue now instead of curlies is, like, indentation-based programming, right? I mean... Yeah, no, I mean, F# uses that, sure. Python, you know, it's and that certainly has yet another level of succinctness to it that is interesting and a bit jarring when you first look at it, but you go, oh, well, that's not entirely crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I personally like the braces still, but as we move in more, I've become more and more succinct and more functional, you know, sometimes these braces look a little too imperative. Do you know what I mean? And that's, anyway.
So Steve Richter asks, why are there both explicit casting as an operator and, let me ask this again, why is there both explicit casting and as operator conversions in the language?
Oh, and the as operator, is that what he's talking
about?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so why do we have casts and with parens and the as operator?
Exactly.
Well, they do different things. One gives you a null when the operation doesn't succeed. So in a sense, it is the as operator is sort of a combo of cast and is, if you will, that works for only a certain subset of types, reference types. So you can't use as with value types, first of all, because we can't represent failure, or we can't represent the case where it wasn't, you know, as a null, and that's why we have the cast thing that raises an exception, but in turn raises an exception isn't necessarily what you want. If it's perfectly valid in the piece of code that you're writing, that sometimes this object is or isn't the type that I'm interested in, and if it is, then I want to do this, and if it isn't, I want to do that. Well, then the as operator is a nice, convenient way of testing and obtaining the object as the target type all in one operation. Where a cast, well, you'd have to now do a try catch and catch the exception, and that's expensive, and so they serve
different purposes,
but there's some overlap. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, there seems to be some confusion around there. Let's see. I want to see. So we could kind of round this out with... Oh, actually, maybe there's some human questions here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what inspires you? Like, when you're thinking about different programming languages or... You don't only Anders doesn't. You don't only think about programming. That's all you think about, right? All the time, programming language. But what inspires you to keep on, you know, pushing the language forward? And that's really his question.
Yeah,
I mean, it's very open ended.
Yeah,
which is great because that means the answer can be almost anything.
I guess I'm always inspired by beautiful code or beautiful solutions to problems, right? I mean, and succinctness inspires me in ways like you look at these functional programming languages and how terse you can make something, you know, and yet still be understandable. Often, terseness comes... There's terseness that you get from just doing punctuation, right? Hey, we could just make this long keyword be the dollar sign, and this long keyword could be the ampersand, and yeah, but now it's just gobbledygook. You can't read it, right? It looks like a regular expression or something. But there are also cases where you sort of boil it down to just a very, very succinct way of stating stuff with, like, in pattern matching and functional programming languages has a certain amount of beauty to it, you know, that I can find inspiration in. We're a different class of programming language in C#, and it's not clear that we could ever put that in, but it's interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. So I love, you know, discovering patterns and then applying them to programming. And ultimately it comes down to just productivity, you know, has always been a thing. I love productive programming environments.
Sure.
Yeah, it's always interesting to, you know, try to understand other programming languages and you kind of go, wow, that's really weird, but that's kind of interesting, you know, that it's done this way over here, or this thing we talked about earlier with, like, the only way that you can totally hide a piece of information in JavaScript is through closures.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk, right? I mean, yet that's you know, a lot of people are excited about that. Unfortunately, it's also often a very expensive way of hiding this information, but it's interesting, yeah. You know, that no one really ordered that one. That one just sort of accidentally came along,
yeah.
And now is turning out to be a real important part of JavaScript. You know?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah,
And then, well, these are Al asked some questions, so. I got to ask his, because Al is one of the guys who asked the most questions of Channel 9 Live, no matter where we're streaming from.
So,
right on, Al. What do you think about expanding the C# event syntax for better composability interop with things like async Rx?
Not quite sure. Well, I have to say, you know, like, first of all, that speaking of events, you know, I was never really super in love with having a distinction between events and properties. If I had to wish for a simplification around events, it would be that events were just delegate valued properties. But because of our multicasting stuff and, you know, add and remove and subscribe and multiple, which in reality, I don't know how important that really is compared to the additional baggage that it comes along with. So that would be one thing that I could dream about simplifying. I think, you know, in some ways, a lot of one event usage pattern has been this async stuff that you know we talked about earlier, where you know. You pass callbacks, or you set up an event handler for when the async work is completed, and then that ends up being just a bunch of ceremony that really you just want to make it look like a function call, and that's what we're doing with the async stuff. So that's one way I think that we're simplifying a certain class of usage of events. Rx is a different way of doing asynchronous programming that makes you write your code differently. I'm not so much a fan of writing your code differently, you know. It makes you use different control structures or whatever, because you sort of have to write it all in fluent style, where you dot all the things together. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so a for loop is not a for loop; it's a dot for each of here's a lambda that you want to do for each of them. And yeah, that's great for certain kinds of things, but you know, for loops have other capabilities that. You know, like the ability to break out of them and whatever that you don't get with that style of programming. So I like sort of just keeping our existing paradigms and giving them new capabilities, you know.
Sure. And I think one of the great things about async is the way that your code, it looks sequential.
Yes.
And it's imperative, it's sequential.
Well, exactly. And then it just, all of a sudden, you can see the forest for the trees, right? And you can just think about the problem at hand, the algorithm, as opposed to the mechanics of working your way through this asynchronous workflow, right? And all of the handlers that have to be set up and the try-catches around them and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
You know, which is really just noise, right?
Absolutely. And Rx, I mean, it's from in terms of language feature, I mean, it's a great library.
Yeah.
High-powered event. Yep. You know, link.
Yep. For streaming. Streaming asynchrony is.
The last question from Al is, and this is kind of an interesting one because I don't think I already know your answer, but I'm going to ask it. What features would you like to, if you could, let's pretend like you didn't have the compatibility elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
What features would you like to remove from your language? Like, what features do you think and go, you know, I'm sure Brendan Eich would want to remove some of his mistakes.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm not saying that there's mistakes in the language, but this is what Al wants to know.
Well, I mentioned one, like I would have probably wanted to unify events and properties is one, because that would just be one fewer concept. I think, and I've often decried it before, you know, if I had it to do over, I would have separated nullability from value versus reference representation of types, such that, in particular, such that you could have non-nullable reference types, which is the one thing that we don't have today.
Mm.
You know, the ability to say, this string can never be null. You, compiler, warn me if I make a mistake such that I could ever find a null here. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, probably full out 50% of the bugs that you run into in C# code or managed code is null pointer exceptions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've sort of painted ourselves into a corner by saying that all reference types are nullable and you can't have a non-nullable version of them. So we've built an entire library that says everything can be nullable, when in reality you should never pass a null here, and if you do, you get bad results, right?
Sure.
But if we were to go add it now,
mm-hmm.
then we'd break all the existing code out there, because, you know, it's already written, you know, with a less constrained type, right?
Yeah.
So that's a thing I'd love to be able to do over, but I'm not sure we'll ever get a chance to, but...
Well, hey, Anders, thank you for your time. I mean,
sure.
we asked almost all the questions from Niners all that were on here, so that some of them I just kind of put together. Some of them I didn't ask, and no offense to those of you. I determined that they weren't questions that you'd probably be able to answer, because they're not really related to your expertise. So
mm-hmm.
that's my being transparent, Niners. I asked a bunch of them. And thank you, Anders. One thing that I was wondering, just as one last thing.
Okay.
In C#, you can use pointers, of course, in the unsafe blocks. Why is it called unsafe and not native?
Well,
when you guys were designing the language.
Oh yeah, no, we had. The funny thing is that we decided to call a spade a spade. It's unsafe. It's not native. It's not native. It's still managed code. It's still running inside a GC'd environment and whatever.
Yeah.
The whole point is to provide a bridge to native, which is a different kind of code, right?
Sure.
But so it's code where some of the safeties are removed, and therefore we called it unsafe. And
okay.
of course the marketeers wanted us to call it, can't you call it more powerful or somehow like put a positive spin on it? I was like, no, we don't want people writing this.
No.
And we want them to know that this is a thing that is best avoided. So we're going to call a spade a spade.
Right on. All right. great to talk to you, Anders.
Yeah, you too. Always,
and we'll see you again. Hopefully we can do some sort of live event sometime.
Sure. That's always fun.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Take care.
Yeah. Thank you.